Every mother has a story. But the reality of being a mother in this fallen and broken world is that heartache and pain will be part of the journey of being a mother. For some of you this morning, as mothers, you recognize that heartache. There's heaviness in your heart this morning on Mother's Day, because some of you know what it's like to bury a son or daughter. Some of you know what it's like to have a miscarriage or a stillborn. Some of you have heavy hearts this morning because there is a significant strain in a relationship with a son or daughter. And you don't anticipate receiving that Mother's Day call and greeting today. Some mothers have heavy hearts this morning because they have children who are not walking with God, who have rejected God, rejected Christ, rejected the gospel. And your heart is heavy because you don't know if you're going to be spending eternity with your son or daughter. Some of the mothers in this room, their hearts are heavy because of the trials and the challenges that your son or daughter is going through. Maybe there's a marital struggle or a financial struggle or a health issue with the son or daughter. And there's nothing that you can do to fix it, to make it better, to take that suffering, to take that pain away. I also recognize that when mothers become grandmothers, not only do the joys multiply, but also the sorrows multiply. My intent this morning is not to be negative, not to be depressing, but to recognize that the reality of living in this fallen and broken world as a mother is that there's going to be pain, there's going to be suffering, there's going to be heartache that is part of that journey. The other reality is that if not all moms, many moms at times deal with what I refer to as the bad mom syndrome. It usually happens when a son or daughter makes some poor choices, and the mother begins to take responsibility for her children's choices and concludes, if I would have been a better mom, then my son or daughter wouldn't have made those choices. Sometimes moms fall into the bad mom syndrome because they begin to compare themselves with other moms. They look around and they say, oh man, look at what that mom can do and all that she can accomplish. And she always seemed to have it all together. And I bet she never loses it at home with her kids like I do. Also, moms have the unique ability to be very in tune to their own weaknesses, to their own flaws, to their own struggles. And because they are so in tune to their own struggles, they begin to feel like bad moms. And so if you're here this morning as a mother and you can identify with a heaviness of heart, or if there's times in your life where you feel like a bad mom, I want you to take your Bibles and turn to Matthew chapter 1, the first book of the New Testament. Since it is Mother's Day, I'm going to be speaking directly to mothers. So if you're not a mother and in this room, I want to encourage you to follow along. The application will be for all of us. But at the same time, I will be speaking directly to mothers. In Matthew chapter 1, we have the genealogy of Jesus. Matthew begins his gospel by showing his Jewish readers that Jesus was a descendant of Abraham and was a direct descendant of David, thus fulfilling the Old Testament prophecies about the coming Messiah. Matthew's genealogy answered the important question that a Jew would have asked about anyone who claimed to be the king of the Jews. Is he a descendant of David? And Matthew is very clear at the beginning of his gospel account of Jesus with the answer is yes. I'm not going to take the time to read through the genealogy, to read this long list of names. But as you look through that genealogy, I want you to look for how many mothers are identified. If you look at verse 16, we see that Mary, the mother of Jesus, is identified. But other than Mary, how many and who are the mothers that are identified in the genealogy of Jesus? This is audience participation time. I don't want you to call out all the names, but somebody help me out. What are the names of the mothers that are recognized in this genealogy? Somebody give me one. Rahab is identified. If you're following along, look with me. In verse 5, Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. And that's one. Somebody else? Tamar is in verse 3. It says, Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. Ruth, also in verse 5, Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. And I'll give you a hint, there's one more. Bathsheba. You're not going to find her name, but she is clearly referenced at the end of verse 6. It says, David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. Who was Uriah's wife? Who was the mother of Solomon? It was Bathsheba. So isn't it fascinating, isn't it interesting in that this long line of the genealogy of Jesus where we see all of these fathers referenced, that there's four mothers that are highlighted. Why do you think in God's wisdom, there's no coincidence with the Lord, that these four mothers are highlighted? What we want to do this morning is we want to go back to the Old Testament and we want to briefly highlight these four mothers. We want to look at their stories. And what we want to do is we want to connect their stories and say, what are the common denominators in their stories? Or most importantly, what is the message for mothers as we look at these four stories? If you're like me, the story that I'm least familiar with is Tamar, and so turn to Genesis chapter 38. This is the only story that we're actually going to read from the text this morning. I'll summarize and highlight the other three. But let's take a look at the story of Tamar. I want you to know it's going to be a little real. At times it might make you a little uncomfortable. If you have children in the room, you may have questions to answer on the way home. But we are going to read, unedited, Genesis chapter 38, beginning in verse 6. Begins Judah, give you a little bit of a historical context here. Judah is the oldest son of Jacob. He is the oldest brother of Joseph. It says, Judah got a wife for his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the Lord's sight, so the Lord put him to death. Then Judah said to Onan, which was his secondborn, lie with your brother's wife and fulfill your duty to her as a brother-in-law, to produce offspring for your brother. But Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. So whenever he lay with his brother's wife, he spilled his semen on the ground to keep from producing offspring for his brother. What he did was wicked in the Lord's sight, so he put him to death also. Verse 11, Judah then said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, live as a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up. For he thought he may die too, just like his brothers. You get the thought process of Judah. He's saying, well, my first son was married to Tamar, and he ends up dying. So I give Tamar to my second son, and he ends up dying. So he's a little nervous about giving Tamar to his third-born son. And so he says, why don't you go live with your father? Verse 12, after a long time, Judah's wife, the daughter of Shua, died. When Judah had recovered from his grief, he went up to Timnah to the men who were shearing his sheep, and his friend the Adulamite went with him. When Tamar was told, your father-in-law is on his way to Timnah to shear his sheep, she took off her widow's clothes, covered herself with a veil to disguise herself, and then sat down at the entrance to Enam. which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that though Shelah had not grown up, she had not been given to him as his wife. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. Not realizing that she was his daughter-in-law, he went over to her by the roadside and said, "Come now, let me sleep with you." "And what will you give me to sleep with you?" she asked. "I'll send you a young goat from my flock," he said. "Will you give me something as a pledge until you send it?" she asked. He said, "What pledge should I give you?" "Your seal and its cord and the staff in your hand," she answered. So he gave them to her and slept with her, and she became pregnant by him. After she left, she took off her veil and put on her widow's clothes again. Meanwhile, Judah sent the young goat by his friend, the Adamite, in order to get his pledge back from the woman. But he did not find her. He asked the men who lived there, "Where is the shrine prostitute who is beside the road at Enam?" "There hasn't been any shrine prostitute here," they said. So he went back to Judah and said, "I didn't find her. Besides, the men who lived there said, there hasn't been any shrine prostitute here." Then Judah said, "Let her keep what she has, or we will become a laughingstock. After all, I did send her this young goat, but you didn't find her." About 3 months later, Judah was told, "Your daughter-in-law Tamar is guilty of prostitution, and as a result, she is now pregnant." Judah said, "Bring her out and have her burned to death." As she was being brought out, she sent a message to her father-in-law. "I am pregnant by the man who owns these," she said. And she added, "See if you recognize whose seal and cord and staff these are." Judah recognized them and said, "She is more righteous than I, since I wouldn't give her to my son Shelah." And he did not sleep with her again. When the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. As she was giving birth, one of them put out his hand, so the midwife took a scarlet thread and tied it on his wrist and said, "This one came out first." But when he drew back his hand, his brother came out, and she said, "So this is how you have broken out." And he was named Perez. Then his brother, who had the scarlet thread on his wrist, came out, and he was given the name Zerah. I warned you, it was going to be a little raw. How's that for a Mother's Day story? When we read through the genealogy in Matthew chapter 1, and we see the list of the mothers, and we see the name Tamar, the mother of these twin boys, we're like, "Oh, that's so nice, that's so sweet." And then we go back to Genesis 38, and we look at the story. And we say, man, what a messed up family. The dysfunction in those relationships was huge. We recognize that Tamar was not a poster child for the perfect mom or the Mom of the Year award. Out of her desperation for children, she seduced her father-in-law. How sick, how sinful is that? But nonetheless, she is one of the four moms that's mentioned in the genealogy of Jesus. Nonetheless, God chose her to be part of the lineage of his coming son, the Messiah. Again, we want to see if we can make a connection, look for the common denominator between these four mothers. The next one that's referenced in the genealogy is Rahab. In Joshua chapter 2, verse 1, we read this. Then Joshua, son of Nun, secretly sent two spies from Shittim. "Go look over the land," he said, "especially Jericho." So they went and entered the house of a prostitute named Rahab and stayed there. If you're not familiar with the story, the Israelites are getting ready to invade Jericho. And Jericho is going to be destroyed, and they send these two spies, and they go and they stay in Rahab's house. She ends up putting her faith in the Israelite God, the true and the living God, and because of her faith in God, she is spared. And all of the city, all of her family, all of her not her immediate family, but all of her extended family, all of her neighbors are destroyed. And she ends up becoming adopted, taken in by the Jewish community. She ends up marrying a Jewish man, and she becomes part of the genealogy, the lineage of Christ. She's mentioned twice in the New Testament, besides in Matthew chapter 1. In Hebrews chapter 3, it says this, "By faith, the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient." James 2 says this, "In the same way, was not even Rahab, the prostitute, considered righteous for what she did when she gave lodging to the spies and sent them off in a different direction." Isn't it interesting that it doesn't just say, by faith, Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, but it says, Rahab, the prostitute. How would you like to have that as a label? Not just for a short amount of time, but for generations to come. My guess is that when people meet Rahab in heaven, it might be, Rahab, oh, you're the prostitute, right? I mean, think about Rahab's label that has been placed on her. But yet, ironically and interesting enough, Rahab ends up in the lineage of Jesus. The third mother that's recognized in the genealogy of Jesus is Ruth. Guess what? She's not a prostitute, but she is a widow. In fact, she is a Moabite widow who comes to know the God of the Israelites through her mother-in-law, Naomi. In the book of Ruth, we read about how God provides a husband in the person of Boaz for Ruth. And Ruth and Boaz have a son, Obed, who is the father of Jesse and the grandfather of David. So Ruth becomes the great-grandmother of David. The reality of living in this fallen and broken world for Ruth resulted in her being a widow in a culture where women were not valued. The fourth woman, the fourth mother that's recognized in the genealogy is Bathsheba. The story of Bathsheba is this. She is out bathing on the top of her home. David is up in the palace and he's out in the balcony and he sees Bathsheba. And he begins to lust after her and he begins to tell his servants, "Why don't you go and get Bathsheba and bring her here to me?" He ends up sleeping with her. She becomes pregnant. And so now he has even a bigger problem because Uriah, Bathsheba's husband, is at war. He's a general in the army. Uriah knows that he is not the father of this child. And so David makes a decision. He tells his men to put Uriah on the front line so that he would be killed. And that's in fact what happens. He is killed so that David can take Bathsheba to be his wife. In the midst of all of that mess, in the midst of all of that sin, David and Bathsheba have children, one of which is Solomon. Now let me ask you, what is the common denominator between these four moms who are mentioned in the genealogy? Think this through with me. Two of them were prostitutes. Well, the one was a prostitute and the other one conducted herself as a prostitute. Two were widows. Two committed adultery. Three of the four were not Jewish women. Two were Canaanites. One was a Moabite. The common denominator is that they all had a big mess. They all had issues. The brokenness and the fallenness and the sin that entered the world in Genesis 3 had a great impact on all of their lives. But yet, there are no coincidences with the Lord. What was Matthew desiring to communicate? Why did he choose to highlight these four moms? Clearly, Matthew was emphasizing that God's choices in dealing with people are out of His grace. In other words, that God uses and chooses and blesses people despite their struggles, despite their past. And perhaps Matthew included these mothers as a way to put Jewish pride in its place. But what is the message for mothers from the genealogy of Jesus? It's this, that God can bring redemption out of any heartache or mess. Isn't that what God did in these four situations? God brought redemption. He brought good out of those four heartbreaking situations. God is at His best redeeming difficult and painful situations. Not just in the genealogy of Jesus, but throughout Scripture we see God bringing good out of pain and suffering. Think about Deanna's story. Think about how dark. Think about the brokenness and the mess in a husband who she referenced being bruised, with children without a father, with five children under the age of four. But that wasn't the end of the story. God was able to redeem that story. The picture of all those children and grandchildren reflects the redemption that God is able to bring in the midst of the heartache and the pain and the heaviness of your situation. If you're here this morning and you're a mom and your heart is heavy because of some pain and some suffering related to your children and grandchildren, I want to remind you that God desires to redeem that situation. He desires to bring His redemption into that situation. It might not be in the timetable that you want. It might not look, His redemption might not look what you are hoping for. But when God looks at the chaos, when He looks at the hurt, when He looks at the pain in your family, He's not overwhelmed. He's not stressed out. He looks at those opportunities as opportunities to reveal His glory, to reveal Himself, to reveal His goodness, to reveal His grace. As we think about the fact that God wants to redeem your situation, that He wants to bring good out of that situation, it's a reminder that as a mother, you're not capable of redeeming that situation. The situation that you find yourself in with your children and grandchildren are too big for you. You don't have the power. You don't have the ability. It's a reminder of who God is and who you are. Because what do mothers want to do? Mothers want to make everything better. They want to fix all of that. And as mothers, you find yourself in a situation where as you acknowledge that God can bring redemption in that situation, you find yourself in a position where you need to wait upon the Lord. The Bible says an awful lot about waiting upon the Lord. Let me just highlight a couple of verses this morning. Psalm 27 says this, "I am still confident of this, that I will see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living." Maybe you're a mom and you're like, "Oh man, this side of eternity, this situation is never going to get better." But the psalmist says, "I am still confident of this. I will see the goodness, the redemption of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait for the Lord, be strong and take heart, and wait for the Lord." Next slide. Jeremiah says this, "I say to myself, the Lord is my portion. Therefore I wait for Him." Moms, as you wait on God to bring redemption to your situation, as you wait upon Him, remember the Lord is your portion. The Lord is enough. The Lord is good to those whose hope is in Him, to the one who seeks Him. It is good to wait quietly for the salvation, or it could also be translated, the deliverance that the Lord, the deliverance of the Lord. Isaiah 30:18. "Yet the Lord longs to be gracious to you. He rises to show you compassion. For the Lord is a God of justice. Blessed are all who wait for Him. The message for mothers in a genealogy of Jesus is that God is able to redeem and bring good out of any situation in your family. And you find yourself in a situation where you can't fix it. You can't make it better. But you find yourself with the privilege to wait upon God. Not waiting with resignation, but waiting with a sense of anticipation. Because you understand who God is and His character. The second message that flows from the genealogy of Jesus for mothers is that God uses imperfect, and I'm going to say ordinary, and by ordinary I mean the fact that these four mothers all had struggles, all had issues, all had a past, like every mother in this room. But God uses imperfect and ordinary moms for extraordinary purposes. For moms who deal with the bad mom syndrome, the stories of these four moms should provide you with some hope. Clearly, the message for mothers from the genealogy of Jesus is that God uses imperfect moms for extraordinary purposes. God chose and used four imperfect moms, despite their past, to be in the genealogy of Jesus. God's purposes for their children, grandchildren, and descendants were not based on their performance as moms. Let me state that again. God's purposes for the children, for the grandchildren, for the descendants of those four moms was not based on their performance as a mom. God had laid it all out from the beginning. When sin entered the world in Genesis chapter 3, God had put in motion a plan of redemption through His Son, Jesus Christ. It was not a haphazard plan. He wasn't sure how it was all going to play out and if Jesus or when Jesus would show up or to whom Jesus would be born or who would be His grandfather and great-grandfather. It was all laid out. God's purposes were accomplished through the brokenness, through the mess of those mothers' lives. And the mess and the brokenness and the heartache in those mothers' lives did not thwart God's ordained purposes for their descendants. Here's a Mother's Day verse for you. Psalm 139, verse, next slide. Psalm 139, 16. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. Mothers, process and think about what is the implication, what is the application for this verse for you as a mom? That your son or daughter, their days were ordained before one of them came to be. I understand that there's consequences for choices. And clearly, there was significant consequences for those four moms and the choices they made and the events that happened in their life. I recognize that as moms, there's a tremendous responsibility in being a mom. That your choices as a mom don't only impact your life, but impact your children and grandchildren and the descendants to come. But my hunch is that the moms in this room understand that reality. They understand that responsibility. And they feel that pressure. But what I want to remind you of this morning is that because God's purposes for your children will be accomplished, you can rest in the sovereignty of God. You can rest in who God is. You need to understand who you are in light of who God is. God is infinite. You are finite. God is all-powerful. You are unable to redeem and to fix. The beauty of Psalm 139, verse 16, is the outcome of your children and grandchildren are not dependent upon you. The outcome is dependent upon God. And as you begin to understand who God is, His greatness, His character, it'll allow you as a mom to be a mom from a place of rest. Not from a place of anxiety, not from a place of stress, thinking that the outcome of your children depends upon you. Yes, your choices are important, but at the end of the day, you can rest. Because God's purposes will not be thwarted for your son or daughter. And the mess and the chaos in your life, God's going to use all of that to shape and to mold. And that's all part of where He wants to take your son or daughter. Let me end with some verses that speak to the sovereignty of God. And I want you to read these verses from the perspective of a parent, from the perspective of a mother, as you think about your children. The Lord foils the plans of the nations, but He thwarts the purposes of the people. But the plans of the Lord stand firm forever, the purposes of His heart through all generations. Next. Many are the plans in a man's heart, but it is the Lord's purposes that prevail. The Lord's purposes for your son or daughter will prevail. The Lord Almighty has sworn, surely as I have planned, so it will be. As I have purposed, so it will stand. For the Lord Almighty has purposed, and who can thwart Him? His hand is stretched out, and who can turn it back? As a mom, you can parent from a place of rest. The outcome of your children is not dependent upon you. So let's tie it all together this morning. Part of the reality of living in this fallen and broken world as a mom is that there's going to be heartache, there's going to be heaviness. But as we look at the genealogy of Jesus, we see that God can redeem and bring good out of any and every situation. And we see that as moms, you can wait upon God to bring that redemption, to bring that good. We also see that God uses imperfect moms for extraordinary purposes. And as moms, we can rest in God's sovereignty. We can rest in His character. We can rest in His purposes. My hope and my prayer for you as a mom is that this week you would be able to wait upon the Lord, that you would be able to be a mom and a grandmother from a place of rest, understanding who God is.